light-sensitive central nervous system also tend to have hypersensitive intestinal linings. One reason is that their adrenaline tends to get released more often because their senses are heightened as they scan their every surrounding for triggers. When you walk into a store that you think could affect you, you can get nervous, rightfully so, given your past exposures and reactions. And that nervousness can trigger the adrenals to jump in and defend you, with a mild fight or flight occurring. Same if you're concerned about superbugs and you walk into a hospital to visit a friend. You're going to go in there with heightened anxiety, which is going to get the adrenals releasing adrenaline. Over time, this increased amount of adrenaline oversaturates the liver, as you've heard about, and can also saturate the intestinal linings, giving them a mild scorching. The thousands and thousands of nerves in the intestinal linings can become inflamed and exposed, with nerve receptors irritated. Eating different foods, you may experience discomfort as they rub the intestinal linings, touching all these sensitive nerves. It's easy to have a fearful response when this happens. Someone may say, "I can't eat lettuce." I react, "But eggs are okay." The irony is that lettuce actually helps to massage intestinal linings, loosening debris and other pockets of waste matter so they can be eliminated and not provide viral fuel, while eggs feed pathogens such as EBV, resulting in more neurotoxins, eventually creating more chemical and food sensitivities. Eggs feel good going down because they travel down the middle of the intestinal tract, turning into smooth, liquefied glue. Lettuce, on the other hand, starves EBV. Part of its magic lies in brushing the intestinal linings, yet with irritated nerve receptors there, it can easily feel like you're having a reaction to it. Ultimately, lettuce soothes nerves. The milky substance in its core has an overall tranquilizing, sedative effect. Apples are another food that people commonly worry they can no longer eat. In truth, apple sensitivities trace back to someone biting into an apple covered with wax and pesticides that hadn't been washed off first. When that happens, the tongue will instantly pick up on the chemicals and sensitive trigeminal and vagus nerves, which connect with the mouth, will trigger a reaction that may include itchiness, tingles, numbness, or a burning sensation. Chemically sensitive people who have experienced this often have to stay away from apples for a little while, and then may find that if their nerves calm down, they can try an organic apple, peeled if needed, without having a reaction. It can seem like a vicious cycle where you're sometimes reacting to the very foods you know should offer relief. If that's the case for you, go slowly with bringing in special foods from Chapter 37 and use your energy to focus on avoiding as many of the liver troublemakers from Chapter 36 as you can, particularly the troublemaking foods in that list, to see progress. Turn to the chapter on hidden PTSD in Medical Medium if you need moral support. Above all, remember that you can still heal. Nobody with a chemical or food sensitivity is barred from feeling better someday. When you tend to your liver and nervous system, there is hope. You're not the problem. If your nervous system is very sensitive, you may still react to certain exposures after you heal. You'll still have to follow certain boundaries and rules that you decide for yourself. Walking into a linen store, for example, you may still get a headache or feel wiped out from the chemicals used to treat the fabric. What will improve is your bounce back time, and getting back to normal faster makes all the difference. Here's the thing. You have a right to react to a world that's toxic. You're not the problem. The toxic chemicals and constant stressors are. Sensitivity is a value. You're the canary in the coal mine. Even if your sensitivities go away completely with liver and nervous system care, they've left you with a gift, a heightened awareness of the perils of our world, so that you can better protect yourself and your family for the future. Chapter 21. Methylation Problems. If you've ever heard that you have a gene mutation that's responsible for methylation issues, it must have felt like an instant judgment that you have a faulty, destructive, unsupportive element of both your body and who you are. You might have been prescribed certain vitamins and other supplements meant to support the ability to methylate properly, though that likely didn't take away the feeling of defeat. When there's something making you feel unwell, that's hard enough to bear on its own. Add to that the gloom of being told you were born with an unfixable gene issue, or that a gene mutation problem mysteriously developed along the way, and that makes matters much worse, especially since this isn't true. Methylation dysfunction isn't a gene problem. It's not a methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase, MTHFR gene mutation. A gene mutation cannot cause a methylation compromise, breakdown, or disorder. A methylation issue is much bigger and different from popular recent beliefs in the alternative and conventional medicine worlds. Here, we're going to explore the truth of what causes a methylation problem and what causes a misreading on a gene test. What methylation means. First, what does methylation really mean? It's the body's ability to receive, absorb, and assimilate key, critical nutrients that we get through healthy foods, as well as from water we drink, water that touches our skin, sun exposure, and fresh, clean air. When we take in a phytochemical, vitamin, mineral, or other nutrient, our body alters its chemical structure to fit perfectly to what we need most. It's a process that breaks down, alters, and makes nutrients more bioactive so they can benefit us in a more profound way. Mainly, methylation is a miraculous role that your liver plays, day in and day out, during both your waking and sleeping hours. Your liver does it with the help of your ileum, a small piece of digestive real estate at the end of your small intestine, just before the colon. In order to convert nutrients for your body's best use, your liver and ileum work with each other, play with each other, rely on each other, communicate with each other, and back each other up. When one is hurting, the other will try to help. Hepatic portal vessels draw critical nutrients from the ileum to the liver, with capillaries coming off the ileum and flowing into the portal system so they can end up in the liver's good hands. When the ileum is not functioning well, most any nutrients coming into the portal vessels from the ileum are diminished, and the liver is left to cope. Testing. Not what it seems. When an MTHFR mutation test comes back positive for an MTHFR gene mutation, a patient ends up with a diagnosis of a gene mutation, commonly of C677T or A1298C. It seems to make all the sense in the world that a gene mutation test would tell you if you have a gene mutation. Here's the thing. It's not actually a gene mutation. The gene is not injured or mutated or altered, even though we're told that's what the test determined. Not only is the testing process itself fallible, it doesn't accurately measure for a mutated gene. Just because science is able to view DNA under a microscope doesn't mean that's what they're doing here. And when they do look at genes in other circumstances, it doesn't mean that they understand everything about them. All gene mutation tests are just testing for the presence of inflammation, not what's causing it, not what it really means, only its markers. What can be a positive aspect of testing is if it identifies that you have elevated homocysteine levels and an issue around methylation. If you've ever had a homocysteine test, you'll notice that in your blood work, it's listed under inflammation. It's good to uncover inflammation and methylation issues if they're happening. People with chemical sensitivities have methylation problems too, and that can trigger a positive on a gene mutation test and/or show up as elevated homocysteine levels. At the same time, this positive side of gene mutation testing is not enough to override the negative aspect, which is the damage that can occur to someone's mind and body when told she or he has faulty genes. You would think that the faulty gene answer gives people relief because it's presented as an answer. Truth is, it doesn't give relief because it's not an answer. It's a deception and a detour into the world of medical bureaucracy to avoid finding the real truth of why chronic illness is elevating rapidly on a global scale. Be prepared to see everywhere in ads, commercials, studies, reports, articles, books, that genes are responsible for everything. It's an endless campaign. If you've received an MTHFR gene mutation diagnosis, you need to let go of the gene mutation part and hold on to the methylation issue part and focus on resolving the true cause of that in order to improve your health. Know the truth of why testing even showed a gene mutation, that it picked up on markers of inflammation, not a mutation itself. How right goes wrong. How does a methylation problem occur, and what happens when it does? As we touched on, one of your liver's over 2,000 functions is the ability to change and convert nutrients to more usable, available, bioidentical forms so you can get the most out of what you're eating to survive. For example, if you eat a spinach salad, those spinach leaves are filled with various B vitamins. Those B vitamins can be helpful in their natural, original state. At the same time, your liver is aware of your body's needs in the moment. So if you're depleted because of, for example, elevated adrenaline from intense stress or an illness developing somewhere within your body, your liver will find and enhance the specific B vitamin you need out of the many that spinach gracefully offers. While medical research and science know about the basic existence of methylation, no one knows that in the methylation process, your liver takes superfoods to a whole new level, with your ileum playing a great role much of the time, creating supervitamins and other supernutrients from regular nutrients. This incredible chemical process that's accomplished by your body, not a science lab, makes nutrition so much more viable and easier for the rest of your body to use than it would be otherwise. Another remarkable aspect of this process is that ahead of time, before you ever ate the spinach salad, your liver documented the need for that particular B vitamin. When the vitamin came, the liver could put it right to use. At the same time, your liver looks out for those nutrients it knows you'll need on the rainy days and dry spells of adrenaline rushes, sickness and other challenges, such as getting exposed to pesticides, fresh paint, or other troublemakers. As you eat your salad, your liver is storing up other B vitamins, as well as other nutrients in the spinach, that it knows will come in handy one day. What it collects is all very specific to you and your needs. Someone else's liver will store a different balance of nutrients from what your liver stores for you. Your liver continues to rely on you to make nutrients available to it on an ongoing basis. So if you're not eating spinach salads and other nourishing foods, where's the liver going to get the nuts and bolts it relies on to make methylated supercompounds, to store them and then deliver through the bloodstream to areas of your body that are in desperate need? One vitamin that's crucial to your body's ability to methylate many other nutrients is vitamin B12. In truth, the body relies on B12 for tens of thousands of daily functions. It's like flour for a pastry chef. Without it, none of the items in the pastry case could be made, least of all the prized wedding cake. The liver relies on this B vitamin and stores large quantities of it, delving into it continually as part of regular organ function. It also relies on B12 for a function the liver can perform when it's out of stock of essentials. The ability to produce trace amounts of certain nutrients and chemical compounds on its own. Your master chef, the liver, can only do this when it has its key ingredient, B12, in enough supply to send it out to your brain, the rest of your nervous system, your heart, and other places in your body that desperately need it. You may remember from part one that under ideal circumstances, vitamin B12 is one of those nutrients that will travel from the ileum to the liver. Even before that, the B12 methylation process will happen in the ileum. The liver relies on that manufacture and methylation of B12. When the liver is running low on all of the nutrients it needs, even B12, the precious glue that holds it all together, the liver will excrete a chemical compound into your bile to travel through the intestinal tract and deliver a message down to your ileum. If all is as it should be, here at your ileum is a gold mine of B12. In fact, it's better than a mine. It's actually a B12 production centre. Rare microorganisms called elevated biotics, which you get from eating fresh, raw, organic, unwashed or lightly washed produce like cucumbers and leafy greens straight from the garden or farm, live only here in your ileum, and they're also responsible for producing the ultimate methylated form of B12 that absorbs into the channels of your body and finds its way back to your liver when called for, through capillaries that lead to the portal vessel system. This B12 is the liver's number one most important mortar to hold together all the bricks that build the castle of your health. When there's enough of it, the liver stores ample amounts to send into the bloodstream as an assistant to almost every vitamin, mineral, and other nutrient that it releases to aid your body in any way. It's the B12 that makes everything go right. The catalyst, the magic carpet, the royalty that blesses us with vitality. That medical research and science have discovered it is a triumph. That's where the progress stopped. It's like discovering an indigenous culture and deciding there's no need to take the time to study its language or learn from its ways. There's so much more for the medical world to uncover about B12. Your liver is aware of what your ileum is doing, and your ileum is aware of what your liver is doing. They talk to each other. They communicate. They transfer information back and forth. When all is well, they work in perfect harmony to make sure that you don't lose your ability to methylate properly or receive and use critical methylated nutrients, all with the goal of making sure you don't end up with a nutritional deficiency. The harmony goes right until it goes wrong. When you lose your ability to methylate properly, it's common to receive a diagnosis of an MTHFR gene mutation. You may find a great practitioner who offers you recommendations such as good supplements to take, and that can be helpful. It doesn't tell you what went south to give you this diagnosis, though, and it certainly doesn't make you feel like you have the power to change your fate, not when it seems to be written in scientific stone that your faulty genes are to blame and there's no way to change them. The methylation process goes awry when your liver becomes overfilled with sludge along the way. A percentage of that sludge could have been passed down from your parents, and then as time went by, your liver collected more gunk. It's the same usual suspects that you've seen throughout this book, including herbicides, pesticides such as old DDT, still in the environment from years past, toxic heavy metals, antibiotics, other prescription drugs, and problematic foods that make your liver struggle in this case. These troublemakers alone are not enough to land you with one of the MTHFR gene mutation misdiagnoses, though. You need one more critical component. A virus. That's right. It takes a virus in the mix to cause a true methylation disorder. Not just any virus. A virus in the herpetic family. This includes shingles, HHV6, and even cytomegalovirus, though the main culprit is EBV. The virus, which for some is passed down from parents, can quietly live its life inside the liver, slowly building its numbers there and excreting poisonous viral waste. The viral waste buildup in the liver, together with the other liver troublemakers there, can cause the organ to become sluggish, which hinders its ability to communicate with the ileum properly and efficiently, store enough B12, and prepare and deliver B12 throughout the body. As the liver becomes burdened over time, it needs more help from the ileum, which in turn overworks itself. If our diet isn't good, and we don't choose foods wisely, the ileum will lose its capacity to create its own variety and coenzyme of methylated B12 for the survival of us and our liver. It's this troublesome combination of the liver not having enough B12 already on hand, no B12 coming from the ileum's production line, and the liver being too compromised to produce B12 for itself that brings on a methylation condition at its worst. When the liver sends the other stored nutrients into the bloodstream for other organs to use, there won't be that glue, that pastry chef's flour, that bioavailable, perfectly prepared methylated B12 to come with them for maximum absorption that helps prevent deficiencies. Even if you get a blood test that shows high levels of B12 in your bloodstream, this doesn't mean enough B12 is present in your organs, central nervous system, and other important areas of your body. Medical research and science are unaware that the central nervous system and rest of the body can be deficient in B12, even when it's high in the bloodstream. That high reading is also no reflection of the viability of that B12, how methylated or usable it is. In fact, a large amount of B12 in the bloodstream can indicate that the body isn't able to put it into use. By the way, while taking a supplement of methylated B12 from a vitamin lab is good, and we need it when our body processes break down, nothing can compare to the methylation that your body performs when the ileum and liver are given the right tools to work as they should. Even when you have all of this going on with the ileum and liver, it doesn't automatically trigger a positive on an MTHFR gene mutation test or result in elevated homocysteine levels. That happens when someone has been viral for long enough that the liver can't hold on to all of the viral waste anymore. At this point, the small cloud of the virus's poisonous byproduct, viral casings, neurotoxins, and even dermatoxins leach into the bloodstream, elevating homocysteine levels and dirtying the blood. Ultimately, it's dirty blood that's the true trigger for a positive on today's faulty MTHFR gene mutation tests. What those tests really detect are elevated inflammation markers due to the blood being filled with poisonous viral waste, as well as other toxins, such as heavy metals escaping the liver. They're just glorified versions of inflammation tests, like the anti-nuclear antibody, ANA, and C-reactive protein, CRP tests, used to diagnose and sometimes misdiagnose chronic conditions such as lupus. If an MTHFR test isn't triggered and homocysteine levels show up as high, that indicates a lower viral load inside the liver with a higher liver toxin load, as well as a worsening condition of the ileum. Remember, it's the high level of toxic debris, much of it viral, in the blood that sets off the MTHFR tests and that spreads the misinformation that your genes are altered and mutated. Correlation, not causation. Oftentimes, MTHFR gene mutations are connected to preeclampsia. So if a woman develops preeclampsia, it will be blamed on a gene mutation. This is a classic case of the medical industry taking two aspects of our health that are not yet fully understood and gluing them together because they happen to be present at the same time. Suddenly, you're being told one causes the other. Medical diagnoses are riddled with these correlation must be causation mistakes for hundreds of conditions. One aspect of your health takes the blame for another when they really have nothing to do with each other, or the connection is not what anyone realizes. The true cause of preeclampsia is a viral condition. It's EBV sitting inside the liver and parts of the reproductive system, such as the uterus. EBV is also what's really responsible for ovarian cysts, fibroids, and many other reproductive conditions and diseases. When a test says that a gene mutation is present, it's an easy source of blame for a problem that no one has understood the cause of all these years. Calling preeclampsia a product of a gene mutation is like having a reaction to a chocolate chip cookie and blaming the distinctive shape of the chocolate chips. The shape of the chips can indicate a certain brand, and that can help us track down its ingredients. It's not the shape itself that's the problem, though. It's only a sign. Positives on gene mutation tests and elevated homocysteine levels are both signs, and we can learn something from them. With today's medical information, we're still far from understanding the truth of what everything means. Thrombosis is another condition wrongfully connected to gene mutations. The true cause of thrombosis is a stagnant, dysfunctional, sluggish, or even pre-fatty liver that's filled with toxins, viruses, and other pathogens. It's not caused by a gene mutation. This is another huge mistake developing in the medical industry. Another example of chronic illness as a free-for-all. With thrombosis, we still need to remember that a weakened liver triggers off a mutation test. Since the liver is also what's responsible for thrombosis, that's why you see the two occur together. They're both products of the same underlying liver issue. Various conditions are going to be connected more and more with gene mutation tests. Soon, someone could have a sniffle, get a positive on a gene mutation test, and be told that the sniffle is caused by a gene mutation. What no one will hear is that a gene mutation test is just a fancier version of the older inflammation tests. If only blood labs listed MTHFR reductase tests under inflammation, just like homocysteine tests, both doctors and patients would be able to see that they're not directly measuring gene mutations. That change may never happen because the focus of the medical research and science in this day and age is genetics, and that ignores the true causes of hundreds of chronic illnesses. Research and science are so close to making the real connections and finding the real answers, yet getting further and further away. Always on your side. It's true that when the liver and blood have been dirtied to the point of setting off an MTHFR gene mutation test, you likely have a methylation issue, because positives on these tests and dirty blood are both indicators that your liver is too strung out to methylate nutrients properly. What's not true is that there's something wrong with the fibre of your being. I'll keep saying it. Methylation issues are not gene problems. It was always outside troublemaking sources, like viruses, that were to blame. Never your own body. For as long as it could, your liver stayed strong against them, to protect you from methylation dysfunction. At a certain point, it became overwhelmed and had to switch over to its life-or-death functions in order to keep you in one piece. Your body was always on your side. When your liver cleanses, revives, rejuvenates, heals and strengthens, nutrients will absorb and process properly. They'll function like nutrients are supposed to function in your body. The ileum will strengthen. B12 will be more bioavailable. Since methylation problems really come down to how sluggish, clogged and dysfunctional your liver is, how many pathogens and toxins are stored inside it, when that's addressed, your concerns about correlated diseases can dissipate. You no longer have to worry about what medical research theorizes is a connection between an MTHFR gene mutation and a higher risk of stroke, heart disease or blood clotting, because you know the truth, that they're about the liver, and you're taking care of your liver. Viral loads that are responsible for preeclampsia, thrombosis and positives on MTHFR gene mutation tests can decrease. Homocysteine elevations, if they were present, can disappear, and so can other markers of inflammation. With a healthy liver, you can leave behind the limits of your diagnosis. With this knowledge, you're on your way to better health. Release the weight of thinking your very DNA is defective and let yourself know peace again as you tend to your liver, clean up your blood, and reclaim your well-being. Chapter 22. Eczema and Psoriasis. Modern medicine has given mysterious skin conditions different labels along the way. Seborrheic dermatitis, other varieties of dermatitis, lupus rashes, hives, vitiligo, age spots, cellulitis, rosacea, actinic keratosis, scleroderma, lichen sclerosis, and of course eczema and psoriasis. Not everyone's skin condition looks the same, though it's not always taken into account. Take, for example, eczema. It's often approached as though there's one textbook variety. This leads to a flurry of misdiagnoses, including the label idiopathic, meaning cause unknown, when someone's skin condition falls outside eczema's narrow definition. The truth is that there are over 100 varieties of eczema and psoriasis. Rosacea is actually one variety of eczema. When someone has a rosacea-style rash on the nose, cheeks, chin, or forehead, it's just a garden variety of eczema that happens to appear on the face, not yet another separate, mysterious skin condition. Lupus is a popular label too. Instead of getting to the bottom of what causes this style of mystery rash, medical communities often tag it as autoimmune, explaining that your body's attacking itself, which is not correct. One misdiagnosis leads to another, one confusion to the next. You don't know what the rash is, you don't know why someone has fatigue, so you put it in the category of lupus? And what's lupus? Medical research and science don't know, which makes it impossible to diagnose properly. It's an arbitrary word for a confusion of symptoms. Hives are another mystery, understood on a basic level as a flurry of histamines causing a rash to develop. If you break out with an acute rash and head to the emergency room, the first thing the doctor's going to say is, "What did you eat?" If you say you had a turkey sandwich, the doctor will likely dismiss food as the cause because turkey seems so normal. If, on the other hand, you tell the doctor you ate strawberries, the doctor will likely say it seems you're allergic to strawberries. If you ate a ham sandwich, the doctor will say it's not the cause of your hives. If you ate an apple, the doctor will blame the apple. If you ate a slice of pizza, the doctor will say that wasn't the problem. If you ate granola, the doctor will say the oats, nuts, or seeds are to blame. If you ate chocolate ice cream, the doctor will say that's not it. If it was raspberry sorbet, the doctor will say that's the sauce. That's the way doctors are taught to think, and their training will come across as certainty, even though those assumptions about which food can cause a reaction aren't always right. If there's no obvious, normal explanation, and the hives are reoccurring with no discernible pattern and nothing to connect the dots, doctors will often throw them into the idiopathic, chronic allergy realm. Translation? We don't know why you're having these reactions. If the skin condition persists, then these days, doctors are very likely to call it autoimmune. That is, to make that lupus diagnosis. If it's not enough to say that it's allergic or autoimmune, they'll blame it on genes. Telling someone you have a skin condition because your mother, father, or an earlier ancestor suffered with one makes surface-level sense that stops everyone from digging deeper. Even if your foremothers and forefathers didn't suffer from skin conditions, it will be called genetic. Doctors want to have answers for patients, which is honourable and makes it all the more unfortunate that they're not always the right answers. Unwanted liver residence. What do mystery rashes really stem from? Almost every single skin condition comes from the liver. The intestinal tract often becomes involved by default in a forced collaboration. However, conditions labelled eczema, psoriasis, rosacea, lupus, cellulitis, vitiligo, age spots, other discolorations, and more start and end with the liver. Even acne and cellulite derive from the liver. More on acne in the next chapter. These conditions begin because something gets inside the liver that shouldn't be there. Is there anything inside your home that shouldn't be there? Dirt, clutter, garbage, spiders, dust mites, a gas leak? These problems seem to have a way of finding their way in, even when we don't want them. And when they get there, they can cause problems. That's how skin issues start. As unwanted guests in the liver. What type of skin condition develops depends on what type of poison or pathogen is there and how much is built up. Medical research and science don't realise this because current scanning doesn't allow them to see when a liver is filled up with viral cells and various toxins. What they can't see, they can't understand. Meanwhile, the autoimmune theory that medical communities use blames skin conditions on your immune system, treating your skin like an enemy, betraying you out of nowhere and starting to eat away at your epidermis, causing inflammation. This mistaken theory is impossible. While your body can get overloaded and its functions strained, it never betrays you. One of the most antagonistic toxins when it comes to skin conditions is copper. Copper pipes are a common source of this heavy metal. Pesticides, such as DDT and its modern-day pesticide cousins, are also high in copper. You could have accumulated it from direct exposure throughout your lifetime and also have inherited it through your bloodline, mind you, not genetically, from ancestors who were saturated in it. Mercury in the liver is the next big instigator of skin conditions, along with pesticides, herbicides, solvents, petroleum products, even pumping gas at the gas station can expose you. Antibiotics and other pharmaceuticals. As these troublemakers build up over time in your liver, the organ grows sluggish, and as we just saw in the previous chapter, when the liver becomes overloaded, it can't detox as well as it should. Its functions slow down. Sometimes, these poisons in the liver can be enough to trigger a skin condition that confuses multiple doctors, although it may be nothing more than a random rash or itchy dry skin that keeps you up at night once in a while. The dermatoxin effect. When a pathogen, such as EBV, is also residing in your liver, that's when the more disruptive skin conditions appear. Different pathogens and even different strains of the same pathogen have different appetites for different toxins. Depending on which combination is present in your liver, you'll get a different rash. One strain of EBV can prefer copper's flavour, for example, resulting in a difficult case of eczema. Another EBV strain can prefer mercury, leaving you with fatigue and a hive-like, butterfly-shaped rash that sticks you with a lupus diagnosis. The skin reactions form because as EBV feeds off its desired food, it also eliminates it, releasing a much more toxic, destructive form of the original copper or mercury, that is, a dermatoxin. A vaporized methyl toxin. This dermatoxin can travel through connective tissue and organs with ease. If your liver is in good working order, the methyl toxin will find its way into your small intestinal tract and colon and flush out relatively easily if you're also eating well enough, exercising, and eliminating properly. If you're like most people, though, then you have a sluggish liver. So this remanufactured poison can back up into the lymphatic system and reverse course back into the bloodstream. This doesn't automatically mean you'll have a problem. At first, most people's bodies are resilient, even if the liver's stagnant, with toxins backing up and the intestinal tract not working well, perhaps constipation is occurring. The body will try its other escape routes for the methyl toxins, for example, through the bloodstream, into the kidneys, and out through your urine. The backup plan can eventually run its course, and sensitivities can start to occur. Food allergies can be a sign that something is going wrong. Even basic histamine reactions, like true hives, can be indications that the liver is not functioning as it should be and poisons are accumulating. A small rosacea rash can appear, or a larger lupus-style rash can take shape, either accompanied by other lupus symptoms or on its own without other symptoms. For some people, a touch of eczema on the arms, elbows, chest, or back of one ear can develop. That's the beginning. If the remanufactured methyl toxin form of copper and/or mercury, the dermatoxin, continues to proliferate due to the pathogen feeding continually, the body can become overrun. The toxins will really start to make themselves known, finding their way up to the skin more and more, leaving deposits in the subcutaneous fatty tissue and getting trapped there. It's unknown to medicine that the subcutaneous fatty tissue under your skin is actually your second liver. Here, you have a natural defense mechanism meant to work any toxins up through the layers of your dermis and epidermis so that they can finally make their way to your skin's surface and out of your body. Helping you rid yourself of toxins is one of your skin's true purposes. Now, this natural process is meant for normal everyday bodily toxins, not engineered, manufactured, man-made or manipulated ones like viruses and the chemical industry's finest pesticides, fungicides, herbicides, solvents and toxic heavy metals. We were never supposed to be up against the harsh chemical inventions that we are today. The liver's not supposed to contain them. Viruses, like EBV, were never supposed to take the destructive forms that they've taken as a result of feeding on those chemical inventions. By extension, the skin was never meant to deal with the dermatoxins created from virus cells, fueling themselves on industrial brews. No one on the entire planet is supposed to have eczema. While it can feel like your skin is working against you, the truth is that it's still on your side, working in your favour, doing the right thing. Without those man-produced troublemakers, eczema couldn't develop. What doctors ought to be telling you is, we've taken a scratch sample of your skin cells and determined that you have a dermatoxin present. It's a remanufactured poison. In this case, specifically, a mix of mercury with copper that's 80 years old, combined with the viral waste and its protein, which comes from a virus called EBV, that's actually feeding on copper deposits in your liver. This indicates that a virus toxin reaction in your liver is the source of the mercury and copper taking on this more toxic form that's causing your skin irritation. Your body isn't responsible for the problem. Your body's not attacking itself. Your genes aren't the issue either. The treatment plan is to go after the virus and kill it off while starving it of its favorite foods in your diet. This will bring back your liver so your skin can heal. That's the explanation that doctors need to be able to say they learned from the finest, most elite medical schools. And yet, that's not what's being taught. Unless a miracle occurs and modern medicine gets up to speed with this information in record time, that's not the talk you're going to get at the doctor's office anytime soon. It could take decades and decades for medical research and science to hand dermatologists what they need to correctly and fully inform patients about their chronic mystery rashes. Remember, at its most advanced, medicine is stuck back at the mistaken autoimmune theory that your immune system is attacking your skin. That's the best reasoning out there right now. Think about how far there still is to go to catch up with the truth. So releasing dermatoxins, formed by viruses feeding off heavy metals and other toxins in your liver, to the surface of your skin is your body's masterful way of protecting you. The skin knows your liver is getting overwhelmed, and in a panic, it pushes poisons up to the surface in a rush. The dermatoxins, which are at least far away from your internal organs now, do make life uncomfortable. They're highly inflammatory to skin tissue, causing blemishes, fissures, cracks, scabs, flaking, scarring, bleeding, and rashes of all kinds. The associated irritation occurs because of tiny nerve endings all through the epidermis. When inflammation occurs, the nerves get squeezed and pulled apart, causing the itchiness, discomfort, and outright pain of the rash. The level to which these symptoms disrupt your life can depend on the strain of EBV or other virus present. The levels of heavy metals or other toxins present inside the liver, how sluggish the liver is, and your current diet, which could contain unhelpful foods that are feeding the underlying cause, the viral strain. What's behind your skin condition? As I mentioned, different types of skin conditions come from different troublemakers in the liver, providing different types of pathogenic fuel. Eczema is a combination of half copper and half mercury with a virus, most commonly EBV. Psoriasis is a combination of approximately 3/4 copper with 1/4 mercury with a virus, most commonly EBV. Rosacea is usually mercury-based, with that mercury present in both the liver and the small intestinal tract, plus a virus, most commonly EBV. Lupus-style rashes are also mercury-based, this time with more EBV involved. Age spots are caused by dermatoxins made of one half methylated aluminum and the other half a mix of methylated cadmium, nickel, lead and mercury. Different types of age spots depend on the composition of that second half. Lichen sclerosis results from a virus in the liver consuming copper, mercury and traces of inherited DDT. The resulting dermatoxins can go anywhere, though they tend to stay lower in the body, most of the time from the waist down. That's because the traces of DDT in the dermatoxins tend to pull them downward when they enter the bloodstream and settle in the lymphatic system. So when the dermatoxins surface at the skin level, that tends to be in lower areas of the body. Often confused with eczema, this condition is different. In lichen sclerosis, the skin becomes more fragile. It's also often confused with common dermatitis at first, and then later considered to be an autoimmune condition when it doesn't improve. Make no mistake, this is a viral condition of the liver. It's not genetic either, though believing so is a classic medical blunder. Any occurrence through the family line is because of DDT passed from generation to generation. Scleroderma is a version of psoriatic arthritis, which is basically an eczema or psoriasis accompanied by deeper tissue pain, joint pain, and often sensitivity to cold and heat. Once again, the body is not attacking itself, and it's not genetic. In scleroderma, a different EBV strain than the common eczema ones is at work, and it's feeding on more mercury than copper. Common sources of mercury here include pesticides, insecticides, and fungicides. Symptoms come from dermatoxins and neurotoxins, combined with dermatoxins affecting the skin and neurotoxins affecting deep connective tissue and joints. Vitiligo is another viral condition, not genetic or the body attacking itself. This one is different from rashing conditions. Here, dermatoxins injure the cells that produce skin pigment, which are hypersensitive to these poisons. These dermatoxins come from a virus, HHV6, or occasionally an EBV variety, sitting inside the liver, feeding on formaldehyde, as well as aluminum and some copper. Mainly, it's larger deposits of aluminum interacting with traces of formaldehyde that makes the dermatoxic solution destructive to pigment-producing cells. Seborrheic dermatitis comes from a toxic liver. In this case, there's no viral relation. It's not a pathogen causing the issue. It's a liver that is high in a little bit of everything that's also on the verge of becoming pre-fatty. The sluggish liver is resulting in dirty blood, and the toxins it contains coming to the surface is what causes the symptoms here. Classic dermatitis is a garden variety of psoriasis, caused by a virus inside the liver feeding off copper, a little bit of aluminum, and pesticides and traces of DDT. The virus is one of the more common mutations of EBV. Actinic keratosis, in which patches of skin become tough, rough like sandpaper, or slightly bumpy, and can come and go, is one of the many forms of eczema. Here, a specific EBV strain, one of the 60 varieties of the virus, is feeding on higher levels of mercury with some copper. Cellulitis comes from a combination of strep plus dermatoxins. The strep has escaped to subcutaneous lymphatic vessels, and it's the bacteria's interaction with dermatoxins coming out of the liver from a virus there that creates this particular skin condition. symptom cycles. The internal dermatoxins we're talking about in this chapter are different from the external ones, usually associated with the word dermatoxin. These aren't detergents or other irritants inflaming the skin from the outside. Again, they stem from unwanted visitors inside the liver, and the internally produced nature of these types of dermatoxins explains why someone can go through cycles with a skin condition. As our skin, the largest organ, desperately purges dermatoxins to the surface, there's normally another round of dermatoxins being produced inside the liver. That means that one rush of dermatoxins can reach the surface, cause a breakout, and then subside. And meanwhile, there's another batch brewing. If the liver isn't being cleansed or cared for, and the virus or other pathogen isn't being eliminated, then typically, just when it seems the skin has improved, this often happens on a 6-week cycle, here comes another round of dermatoxins up through the subcutaneous tissue, preparing itself to surface at the epidermis and cause another flare-up. Many people with severe skin conditions that require steroids find themselves with an even bigger reaction when they come off the medication because the underlying liver problem was never addressed. Instead, more and more dermatoxins were building up in the liver and subcutaneous fatty tissue. The steroids didn't get rid of the body of these toxins, they got rid of the reaction to the toxins. When the steroids or other immunosuppressive drugs aren't there anymore, the dermatoxins still are, and so the body responds in kind. It's completely understandable when someone goes on steroids for their skin. Some skin conditions can reach torture levels when they're at their peak, so it makes complete sense that someone would go on steroids to get through the hard times. What's important to understand is how they're really working. The medical world believes a steroid is stopping the body's immune system from attacking the skin. In reality, the medication is stopping the body from reacting to dermatoxins produced by a virus. The real reason steroids work for skin conditions is similar to why someone gets put on steroids immediately following cosmetic surgery, to stop the body from becoming inflamed as a reaction to the nose job or multiple incisions. Surgical wounds aren't a result of the body attacking itself, and neither are skin conditions. A skin condition such as eczema or psoriasis normally isn't a quick reaction to a food just eaten. Like chemical sensitivities, it's more of a slow build, which means that it can make itself known at any time. We'll usually put the blame on whatever we're doing in the moment. Maybe it was an apple eaten yesterday or today. Maybe it was a certain salad ordered at lunch. Maybe it was a phone call from a friend. Maybe it was watching too much TV. We find all sorts of possible reasons for why our skin seems to give us trouble. Mostly, we go back to foods, which do play a role. And yes, the foods we eat matter. When healing skin conditions too. Dairy, eggs, and wheat can feed EBV and other pathogens, causing, for example, EBV to produce more viral cells that can feed even more on copper, mercury, and other toxic heavy metals found in sources such as pesticides, herbicides, and pharmaceuticals such as antibiotics. As a result, the virus produces more dermatoxins that make the skin condition worse. Sometimes in combination with virus-produced neurotoxins, which can create additional symptoms such as aches and pains, dizziness, tingles, ringing in the ears, numbness, or, as in the case of psoriatic arthritis, joint pain. Like the doctor in the hypothetical ER scenario earlier, though, you'll likely guess that it was another food giving you a skin reaction, usually a fruit or a vegetable. Here's a common scenario. One day you'll eat an egg and cheese sandwich and then take an antibiotic for your cough. This feeds the EBV in your liver, though you don't get a skin reaction in that moment. 2 days later, the virus is actively using the antibiotic and the egg, cheese, and wheat to produce dermatoxins inside your liver. It's only then that your rash starts to get worse, except because you ate an apple your grandmother offered you that afternoon. You think it's the apple. Truth is, the dermatoxins causing your skin flare-up took time to be produced and released up through the skin. The apple was doing your health a favour, only it got the blame instead. This is just one example of the confusion that can occur with foods. Cleaning house. It's imperative to look after, care for, address, coddle and mind the liver to rid yourself of any skin condition. You'll likely need to pace the process of healing because as the liver is cleansed, dermatoxins flush fast and furious to the skin's surface, causing the same symptoms you're trying to heal. If you flush them all at once, you'll be overcome with discomfort. Not only that, the skin has also grown accustomed to reacting to dermatoxins, so it needs to be given time to calm down. Someone with the worst case of eczema or psoriasis has a little extra copper and mercury and viral waste matter stored deep in the liver, so it takes longer for the skin condition to heal. If that's you, have patience as best you can. Diet means everything. Above all, no matter the severity of your skin condition, keep out the unproductive foods in Chapter 36, Liver Troublemakers. As time goes on, you will see results. For some, they'll happen immediately. For others, they'll be delayed. Eventually, as the liver cleans house, toxic heavy metals will be released and pathogenic loads will reduce to the point of minimizing the skin condition or freeing yourself from it altogether. Chapter 23. Acne. When acne is present, it means that the liver is harbouring a chronic, low-grade level of streptococcus. Strep lives in the organ when the liver holds an abundance of food for it. Antibiotics are one of strep's fuels of choice and one of the liver's greatest enemies. As it happens, they're frequently handed out to those who suffer from acne, along with other medications that can be hard for the liver to bear. It can become an endless cycle, with antibiotics feeding the very strep that causes the acne, and the acne causing the dermatologist to write a prescription for more antibiotics. So, what comes first? The chicken or the egg, or the acne, or the antibiotics? The answer is clear. The antibiotics. Our liver's storage bins of this and other pharmaceuticals can go back to childhood and even babyhood. Like so many other liver troublemakers, they can also be inherited through your family line from foremothers and forefathers, so you can actually enter life with antibiotics stored in your liver. Then your early years often bring them antibiotic prescriptions. Ear infections, for example, are caused by strep, though normally diagnosed as general bacterial infections that call for antibiotics. When ear infections go too far, doctors often prescribe liquid steroid drops and sometimes insert ear tubes to prevent the canals from closing up and stopping the administration of these steroids in times of inflammation. This can be helpful if the infection has become severe. With the baby's first ear infection, though, it normally isn't that bad yet. At that early point in time, the infections can usually be handled easily with natural antibacterials and antivirals such as elderberry syrup, lomatium root, zinc, golden seal, vitamin C, and mullein garlic ear oil. These can head off the need to use antibiotics down the road because they take care of the underlying strep. Here's the thing. Conventional prescription antibiotics don't kill strep as they should, because strep has an unbelievably adaptable nature. It becomes resistant to many varieties of antibiotics, so as we move through the various infections that can occur in life, from those first ear infections to respiratory infections to sinus infections and beyond, with antibiotics prescribed continually for their treatment, the strep in our bodies becomes immune and can even strengthen over time. Urinary tract infections, UTIs, and bacterial vaginosis, BV, which are both caused by strep, are frequently misdiagnosed as yeast infections, that is, candida proliferation, because that's what's apparent to doctors. Antifungals are often recommended. Candida itself is never the problem, it's only the messenger. For more on the truth about candida, see Medical Medium. When UTIs or BV are accurately diagnosed, antibiotics are recommended. This is a great mistake in modern medicine today that strengthening strep bacteria and causing continual, chronic UTIs and yeast infections in so many people, mostly women, as well as BV. The more prescription antibiotics and even antifungals build up in the liver and the fatty subcutaneous tissue beneath the skin, the more strep can use them to build up its immunity, and the more someone can suffer in the long run. Antibiotics always come first. What does all this have to do with acne? Everything. Acne is a result of early wars that go undocumented in people's lives. Everyone who deals with a true acne condition has a history of taking antibiotics before any antibiotics they took for acne. This is the chicken and egg part. Antibiotics always come first. For the very few who struggle with acne and yet never had antibiotics prescribed in early life, not even pre-memory, for example, for a cough at age 2, then the antibiotics were passed down through the bloodline or came into the body through animal protein. It isn't just that strep becomes resistant to antibiotics. It also learns to use them as fuel. When someone afflicted by cystic acne doesn't take antibiotics for it, the strep can still find other sources of fuel. More on what those are soon. Refined petroleum, basically a form of engine oil, is in all antibiotics. Not because it needs to be. It's because industrial deals were made and business contracts were signed probably long before you were born. Plastics as well are in antibiotics. And of course, let's not forget GMO for genetically modified organism. Corn grown for medical use. This type of corn is much different